6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. U.S. President Barack Obama arrives in Peru on Friday for his final Asia-Pacific Economic Corporation meeting, but his presence could be overshadowed by his successor, President-elect Donald Trump. The chairman of the APEC summit, Alfonso Bustamante, is concerned about Trump's campaign promises of walking away from the Trans-Pacific Partnership and renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement, also known as NAFTA.
I hope we are the consensus on the meetings would be of President Trump being a lot more moderate than candidate Trump.
Trump has made it clear that he is hostile to the kind of free trade deals that tend to be the focus of the annual Asia-Pacific Economic Corporation Forum. U.S. President-elect Trump met Thursday with key advisors and candidates for top jobs in his upcoming administration. Trump met in New York with his first foreign visitor, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Mr. Abe called his talks with Trump really cordial. He called Trump a leader in whom he can have great confidence. The president-elect's transition team has submitted paperwork that will allow them to get briefings from the White House. Meanwhile, a Pentagon official says the transition team has contacted the Defense Department and hopes to begin to plan future meetings on Friday. Donald Trump plans to meet this weekend with former Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney. Romney was an outspoken critic, or opponent rather, of Trump during the recent political campaign. But reports say he may be in line to be Secretary of State. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is portraying his country's airstrikes in Syria as limited amid reports on Thursday of heavy casualties in the eastern part of the country. The Russian diplomat spoke to reporters on the sidelines of the APEC summit in Peru following a private meeting with U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry.
We talked about every aspect of Aleppo. The Prime Minister says there isn't bombing. Is that accurate?
Yeah, we are only, our Air Force and the Syrian Air Force only work in the provinces of Idlib and Homs to prevent the ISIL who might be leaving Mosul from getting to Syria.
Syrian activists and rescue workers said airstrikes in Aleppo killed more than 20 people on Thursday amid a major Syrian and Russia offensive in opposition-held areas of Syria. U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power told the United Nations Security Council Thursday that her government will put forward a proposal to impose an arms embargo on South Sudan. The embargo will target those responsible for recent violence in the country. South Sudan has been mired in a political conflict since December of 2013. Getting the council to agree to sanctions may be difficult, with some council members fearing that such a measure would be difficult to enforce and that it would favor the opposition. South Sudan's envoy, Joseph Malak, told council members that denying his government the means to protect and defend its citizens and its borders would undermine its sovereignty. The World Health Organization is warning that a global influenza pandemic remains a real threat despite progress made over the past 10 years in increasing the worldwide supply of flu vaccines. Lisa Schlein reports.
In 2006, the World Health Organization acknowledged that countries around the world were ill-prepared to tackle an influenza pandemic. Global production capacity for pandemic vaccines increased from an estimated 1.5 billion doses to 6.2 billion doses last year. Marie-Paul Kini is the WHO's Assistant Director General for Health Systems and Innovation. She says the world has come a long way in preparing for a flu pandemic.
We are certainly better prepared for an influenza pandemic than we were 10 years ago.
The flu season in the Northern Hemisphere is set to start in December, peak in late January, and run its course by April or May. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Authorities in Pakistan say they have captured a group of 8 people operating a recruiting cell for the Islamic State group. The detainees allegedly recruiting young men to send them illegally to Syria via Afghanistan and Iran. I'm Michael Brown in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Friday, November 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. DRC President Joseph Kabila has named a new prime minister, but the main opposition coalition says he's not their prime minister.
Sami Badibanga is appointed as a new prime minister. According to us, it's not our event. The big event we are waiting for is the departure of Mr. Kabila here to leave the office on the 19th of December.
Abra Puela is a member of the main opposition coalition known as Rassemblement. Former Ivory Coast First Lady Simone Gbagbo will be tried in absentia. More African migrants are settling in other African countries and not Western Europe. And a new survey shows a majority of Ghanaians are confident in the Electoral Commission to administer free and credible elections in December.
We found that there was close to a third of respondents indicated a certain apprehension about the breakout of violence after the result.
Kojo Asante is a senior research fellow at the Center for Democratic Development. Cameroon's government cracks down on social media, and several G20 countries are not living up to their pledges to reduce emissions. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's Africa's Post Roundup, and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila has named a new prime minister, Mr. Badibanga Ntita Sami. He replaces Augustin Matata Ponyo, who resigned Monday to make way for the formation of a national unity government in fulfillment of an agreement reached last month between Mr. Kabila and a smaller opposition coalition. The main opposition coalition, known as the Rassemblement, did not participate in the dialogue that led to the agreement for a unity government. Alba Puela is a member of the Rassemblement. He says President Kabila is not in a position to choose a new prime minister since he must leave office on December 19th. At the end of the year, the conclusion of his second and final term.
Mr. Sami Badibanga, he's a former campaign director of Mr. Etienne Tshisekedi during the campaign of 2011. But when Mr. Tshisekedi refused his members to join the parliament, Mr. Badibanga and others refused, they attended the parliament. So they were revoked by Mr. Etienne Tshisekedi. In a way, since Kabila is in the process of completing his last term by the 19th of December, he can appoint any prime minister he wants. According to us, this is not our problem. Mr. Sami Badibanga is appointed as a new prime minister. But according to us, it's not our event. The big event we are waiting for is the departure of Mr. Kabila here to leave the office on the 19th of December.
When you say he's not your prime minister, don't you think that Mr. Badibanga's appointment is President Kabila trying to reach out to you, the main coalition bloc, the Rassemblement? He would like for you to come and join him to form the new government.
Yes, he wants us to join him, but according to us, we cannot accept because he's someone who has to leave the power, has to leave the office, because the term of his second and last term will be this 19th of December. He has to leave the office. He has to go. So why do he want us to join him in his dialogue? No, we cannot. We are waiting for the date so that he has to leave, and we want to organize this so that elections can take place.
Mr. Puela, why do you think President Kabila chose Mr. Badibanga? Yes. After all, as you said, he used to be a member of Mr. Tshisekedi's party.
You know, Mr. Machiavelli wrote something, "Divide et impera" in Latin. That means you have to divide your opponents so that you can be more powerful. He wanted to divide opposition, but we know that Mr. Badibanga was dismissed. He was revoked. He was no longer from UDPS because he was revoked. He appointed him to show that he wants changement. That's why he appointed someone who's not really from his party, his majority. He wants to divide the opposition so that he can take power. He wants to continue after the 19th of December, but he can't accept. That's why this Saturday we are holding a meeting to deliver a second yellow card to Kabila Kio to the 19th of December, when we get a red one, meaning that we want him to leave the office that day.
So you said that the Rassemblement will hold a meeting this Saturday to give President Kabila a what? A yellow card?
A yellow card, yes. Meaning that we want to advertise him to leave the power.
Alba Puella is a member of the main opposition coalition in the DRC, known as the Rassemblement. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. In Ghana, a new survey conducted by the Center for Democratic Development, the CDD, finds that a majority of Ghanaians say they have confidence in the ability of the Electoral Commission of Ghana to conduct a free, peaceful, and credible election on December 7th this year. Respondents of the survey in parts of the country's northern region also expressed concern that there could be violence after the results have been announced. In an interview with viewers, Peter Clotte, Kojo Asante, senior researcher at the CDD, says the Electoral Commission has seen a sharp rise in the positive perception that Ghanaians have in their Electoral Commission to organize the polls.
We found that there was close to a third of respondents indicated a certain apprehension about the breakout of violence after the result. Now, what we then did was to disaggregate that particular group of people who expressed this apprehension. And when we did that per region, we found out that the majority of the people who were expressing these fears were coming from the northern region, and this is 53% of that respondent group that indicated an apprehension for violence in the post-election.
The Electoral Commission, as well as the police, came up with some concerns that there are certain hotspots in the country that would have to be watched because of concerns of possible violence. And so some measures would have to be taken. Do they tally with your finding, if I may put it that way?
In terms of the hotspots, I think we are all aware of them. The police have, I think, close to 5,000 hotspots. The Electoral Commission has 81 constituencies. So basically, it covers every region. What our findings show is that, yes, in every region, there are people who express certain fear of post-election violence. But what you are not able to do because of the size of the sample is to disaggregate to constituency level and be able to see whether it tallies with the hotspots that both the EC and the National Security Task Force on Elections have identified.
Did your polling find out what percentage of Ghanaians repose confidence in the Electoral Commission's ability to administer a peaceful, credible, transparent general election?
Yes. So we measured two things: EP's level of preparedness, which is basically not just the EP, but other national stakeholders like the police, the army, National Peace Council, and so on. And the EP story, I think, is one of the good news because when we did the Apple Barometer survey in 2014, the EP trust ratings were very low. They were in the 40s. And, of course, this had come at the back of the eight-month election petition, post-election election petition, that where the MPP took the NDC, went to court to challenge the result. Now, that was a low point. When we did the first round of the survey in July, the EC ratings had moved to 63%. And in the current survey that we just did, it's moved to 73%. So there's been a jump of 15% between round one and round two. So that's very positive, I think, in terms of the confidence report in the Electoral Commission. But notwithstanding, there are still concerns about vote manipulation and so on, which we feel that the EC can do more to educate people so that people understand the electoral process.
Kojo Asante is the senior researcher at the Center for Democratic Development in Ghana. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotte from the capital, Accra. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and today is Friday, November 18th. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour, more than half of African migrants actually move to other countries within Africa, not to Western countries, according to Claire Adida, author of Immigrant Exclusion and Insecurity in Africa, Co-Ethnic Strangers. She talks to Ricky Stryak about how conversations around migration need to shift.
I see migration as inevitable. It predates the creation of nation states. It predates the creation of borders. Human beings look for opportunity. They're not going to stop looking for opportunity. One of the ways that they do that is by sometimes moving and going somewhere else. And so I think it's an inevitable phenomenon. And I do think it's a little bit, as you say, futile to talk about how to stop it. You know, even if we build walls, human beings are going to find ways to move and to get around those obstacles.
And your book specifically talks about migration within Africa from one African country to another. And you specifically seem to have done a lot of research in Ghana. You said nearly half of African migrants in Ghana are women. Are they mostly students? I mean, you don't often hear about female migrants. So how is that female migrant experience maybe different than what we see in media most of the time?
Right. So actually, I don't, there wasn't really a focus on gender in my research. It was always kind of present, but I didn't actually analyze gender and migration. But one thing I can say just from thinking back to the fieldwork that I did and the interviews that I led, there are a lot of women migrants, and it's not because they're students, but it's because the migrants I was talking to in Ghana were like informal traders, and a lot of those informal traders are women. And so one thing that's actually really interesting about this migration phenomenon in West Africa is that there's a bit of an empowerment of women going on, because they are making money, they are working, and they are actively a part of this phenomenon.
When we talk about inter-African migration, would increased cooperation and breaking down trade barriers have a negative or a positive effect on inter-African migration, do you think? Because you mentioned the women are often traders, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, so the barriers that I saw in the countries I studied in West Africa, Ghana, Benin, Niger, Nigeria, were informal barriers. So there's a lot of this immigration is happening informally. People are kind of coming and going. And as a result of that, the immigrants in their new host societies are very dependent on their community leaders to be safe, to find resources. And so by being kind of in the shadow, and by keeping immigration in the informal sector, what you have is that you have these immigrants. These immigrants are very vulnerable. They're vulnerable to they're dependent on immigrant community leaders to bail them out when they get stopped by the police. They're dependent on their community leaders to help them find resources when they first come.
That was Claire Adida, author of Immigrant Exclusion and Insecurity in Africa, Co-Ethnic Strangers. She was speaking with Ricky Stryak from San Diego, California. A court in Ivory Coast has ruled that former First Lady Simone Gbagbo will be tried in absentia for crimes against humanity after she and her defense team refused to appear. Her husband, Laurent Gbagbo, is being tried at The Hague, but Ivory Coast refused to transfer his wife. Now, amid uncertainty over the future of the ICC in Africa, her trial may point to some of the challenges that national courts face in dealing with these cases. Emily Job reports for VOA from Abidjan.
As the judge announced his decision Wednesday not to force former First Lady Simone Gbagbo to appear in court to face charges of crimes against humanity, a man in the audience shook his head in disbelief and sighed. A few meters from him, the defense dock stood empty. The former First Lady had previously said she wanted to be tried at home to face her compatriots. Rodrigue Dadje, one of her lawyers, said the decision to go on without her discredits the court.
Si la défense de Madame Gbagbo ne participe pas à ce procès n'est plus crédible.
Dadje says if Simone Gbagbo and her defense team don't participate in this trial, it is not credible anymore. But that's exactly what they want, said General Prosecutor Ali Yeo.
C'est une volonté de décrédibiliser le procès.
He says everybody knows the boycott is a move to discredit the trial. Gbagbo's husband, former President Laurent Gbagbo, refused to concede defeat in 2010 elections and stepped down. The ensuing conflict killed at least 3,000 civilians. Simon Gbagbo is accused of helping to orchestrate killings and attacks against supporters of her husband's opponent. She was already sentenced to 20 years in prison in a separate trial last year for undermining state security and organizing armed gangs. She has maintained her innocence. Laurent Gbagbo now awaits trial at The Hague, but Ivory Coast refused to honor an ICC arrest warrant for his wife. Current President Alassane Ouattara has continued to voice support for the International Criminal Court, even as three African nations have announced they will withdraw. But Ouattara has also insisted that national court should be able to deal with high-profile crimes. Moussa Traoré, deputy president of the Ivorian section of the Coalition for the ICC, says the Simon Gbagbo trial is a test. He says what is at stake is the credibility of the Ivorian justice, because it is a major challenge to show that an Ivorian court is capable of trying such serious crimes. In Abidjan, the general prosecutor dismissed all criticism of the legitimacy of this trial, pointing to the recent trial of ex-Chadian president Hissène Habré in Senegal by a special African Union tribunal.
Vous avez bien vu le procès Hissène Habré, où
Yeo says Habré was brought to the court by force and he didn't say a word. And when the verdict was announced, everybody applauded it as an exemplary trial. He says he believes this trial is absolutely credible because she has plenty of opportunities to defend herself and her court-appointed lawyers will defend her. But when the trial opened in Abidjan last May, human rights groups immediately withdrew their participation as civil parties, claiming, like the ICC, that the Ivorian investigation to prove Simon Gbagbo's culpability was incomplete. The trial has since been delayed several times, most recently when the former First Lady and her lawyers refused to appear after their failed attempt to summon several high-level officials, including National Assembly President Guillaume Soro, to testify. Emilia Provue News in Abidjan.
Social media use has exploded in Cameroon, and so has government's effort to police it. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA from Yaoundé.
These members of the Presbyterian Church Bota in Limbe, southwestern Cameroon, are praying for three local men, Formoso Ivo Fe, Afu Nivilfo, and Azza Levis Gop. They were convicted by a military court this month after allegedly sharing an SMS joke about recruitment for the Boko Haram terrorist group. The proceedings were closed to the public, and Amnesty International and local rights groups condemned the conviction. Among those gathered at the church is Tabot Timothy, a 22-year-old law student at the University of Douala, Cameroon.
It was just normal for a thorough investigation to be carried out to really ascertain the fact that these guys were joking. It is unjust. Thorough investigations were not carried out.
Cameroon's government has used several laws to crack down on mobile and online communications, including a 2014 anti-terrorism law and the newly revised penal code. Barrister George Marcelin Chungi is with the Cameroon Bar Council.
Est puni d'un emprisonnement de 1 à 5 ans et d'une amende de 20 000 à 10
millions. He says prison time of 6 months to 2 years and fines of $10,000 to $20,000 await those who use electronic media to propagate information without proof. He says the sanctions can be doubled if it is found that the communications were intended to destabilize social peace. Police detained a journalist in January after he erroneously reported on social media that President Paul Biya had visited soldiers in the north. In March, police arrested people accused of sharing a leaked confidential letter on social media. The letter was from the country's Minister of Defense and said that Boko Haram terrorists had arrived in Yaoundé. Despite the arrest, social media and mobile messaging apps and networking sites are increasingly popular in Cameroon and are used by opponents and supporters of the government alike. Social media consultant Nelson Tawe.
Social media is inevitable. It's like a devil that you are called upon to live with. It's difficult to suppress it. It's just going to be like throwing water on the duck's back. Social media has come to stay. There's no way you can suppress it. I think that government will have an uphill task to succeed in what it's trying to do.
Cameroon is not the only country getting jittery about the fast form of communication. Several countries in Africa have taken similar measures, and a new report from the Washington-based Freedom House says internet freedom has declined globally for the sixth consecutive year. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Here now is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria, with Daybreak Africa Sports. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good morning, James. We begin with the cheery news coming from South Africa rugby side, the Springbok, whose record try scorer, Brian Habana, is back at left wing for the Springbok as they prepare to face Italy in Florence on Saturday. While the rest of the team that played England in London was kept unchanged, Springbok coach Alistair Coetzee says his team had a good training week in Florence and is looking forward to an improved performance from his side.
The first thing is not to worry too much and look at the outcome. We've got to stay process driven. We've got to make sure that we eliminate those soft moments and be really, really hard on the basics and get that right.
In athletics news, no African athlete was named in the 16 athletes, including 10 medalists who were on Thursday disqualified by the International Olympic Committee for doping at the 2008 Beijing Games. The 10 medalists who competed in weightlifting, wrestling and athletics were all found to have taken banned substances after retesting of samples. In basketball news, Tunisia's ES Sahel qualified for the semifinal of the Arab Club Basketball Championship after beating Saudi Al Fahd 91-56 at a quarterfinal game played on Thursday evening in Seoul. In Nigeria, president of the Nigerian Basketball Federation says 9 teams from the Atlantic Conference and 8 from the Savannah Conference in the lower division will be competing for 2 slots to qualify them for the elite division.
For now, it's only the Premiership that is sponsored for us. And what we try to do is to sell, you know, this lower division.
In other sports news, the 13th FINA World Swimming Championships in Canada, scheduled to hold from the 6th to the 11th of December 2016, will see South African twin brothers Alad and Alaik Basson flying the continent's flag at the championships. The Basson brothers qualified at the SA National Aquatic Championships in Durban. In football news, the Women's African Cup of Nations will start tomorrow, Saturday, when host Cameroon take on Egypt in Game 1 at the Ahmadou Ahidjo Omini Sport Complex in Yaoundé. Defending champions, the Super Falcons of Nigeria, will be led by their coach, Florence Omagbemi, who is describing the Super Falcons as one of the favorites.
As a champion and as a defending champion, any situation you find yourself, you want to make use of it very well. So I would say we will try to do our best with where we are right now and not to make sure we don't let Nigeria down when we go to Cameroon.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Over to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The United States said Thursday that it will press for a UN arms embargo against those responsible for the violence in South Sudan, which has dramatically escalated along ethnic lines. U.S. Ambassador Samantha Powell told Security Council members that such a move would be an important step to help halt the violence by government and opposition forces against civilians that has devastated the country for the past 3 years. And that's it for this Friday, November 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a very good weekend.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, Joyce Banda, the former president of Malawi. She'll discuss what Africa can learn from the U.S. elections and the peaceful transition of power from one leader to another. That's right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kHz and 15580 kHz, We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.